zombies are usually portrayed as mindless ghouls who crave human flesh to survive. But in the new musical, Zombie Bathhouse, the undead are still craving human flesh. They just don't necessarily want to swallow.
Oh.
Zombie Bathhouse tells the story of the hopelessly out of love Michael, who is DJing at a bathhouse during Pride when a zombie outbreak occurs. Michael thinks that this may be the end for him, but it's just the beginning of self-discovery and finding true love.
Aww. Today, the creators of Zombie Bathhouse, with book written by Brian Kirst and music and lyrics by Scott Free, join us to talk about how to survive a zombie outbreak at a bathhouse with a little song and dance.
Listen as we chat about the challenges of staging new work, how zombies have evolved over the years, and why we might consider adding a little Z to our LGBT history.
Or herstory. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Cock. I want cock.
I'll give you some if you just quit saying that. Folks, we have till 10 p.m. this evening Central Time to finish our Kickstarter. If you haven't pledged already, pledge today. We have some stretch goals.
Stretch it up, babies.
We're trying to get to 23,000 so we can include a really fierce cooking challenge in this season.
Extravaganza, the battle royale, where queens, generations of queens, battle each other to find out who is most delicious and will be judged harshly and unfairly by season qualified judges. Will only happen with our stretch goal all the way up to $23,000.
And right now, at the time that we're recording this little intro here, we're only $1,000 away.
I can almost taste it. Ooh. Mm-hmm.
Who will be queen of the kitchen?
Go to cookingwithdragqueens.com and make it possible, because a wig is a terrible thing to waste. And so is a tuna fish casserole. You got any? I'm starving. Our guests today are writer and zombie enthusiast Brian Kirst, who's collaborated with punk rock activist Scott Free to create Zombie Bathhouse, a new rock musical that places all the action inside a gay bathhouse in Chicago, where folks start mysteriously discovering that the regulars are hungry for much more than just cock.
We need you to be our publicist.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be happy to.
That'd be awesome.
So one thing I really enjoyed, we just saw the show. It's a lot of fun. It's right now running here in Chicago at the Center on Halsted till October 29th. And one thing that I thought was really touching, actually, was the portrayal of zombies in this production, not as something necessarily to be feared. But, you know, they're good zombies and there's bad zombies, just like in the TV series based on the comic book I, Zombie, yeah, by Liv Moore,
starring what the character's name is Liv Moore.
Liv Moore, right? And she's a woman who became a zombie who solves crimes by eating the brains of the dead victims.
And she gets their memories, so she can figure out
who did it. And it's a world where there's good zombies and there's bad zombies. Mm-hmm. And in Zombie Bathhouse, zombies are much more than something just to be feared. And you're, of course, making a relationship to LGBT people. Welcome, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Brian, talk to me about your approach to wanting to create a musical about gay zombies in a bathhouse.
Well, first off, the idea originated with Scott, believe it or not, even though I'm the horror guy.
Because Scott's more gay of the bathhouse regular, is that what it is?
Well, I wanted a tribute to the regulars.
But Scott actually came up with a name initially, correct?
Mm-hmm. And that's all it was. It was a name.
You guys are really high.
So you came up
with decided Zombie Bathhouse, man.
Kind of, right?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that you chose to use the Z word, because, you know, a lot of things, they don't use the Z word. Like in Night of the Living Dead, they don't refer to them as zombies. Yeah. And also in The Walking Dead, you never hear them say
they're
zombies.
Walkers, right?
They're walkers,
they're
right? I have a feeling, though, in the final episode, they're going to be like, fucking zombies.
And then, hey, only we get to use that word with each other.
There we go.
Let's be correct. But
what was the attraction to wanting to portray zombies as sort of sympathetic and part of our LGBT family? Or I don't want to give it away, but can we give it away?
Don't give it away. Okay. Don't give it away. Never, not for free.
You include them into later on in the show. There's a civil rights issue about zombies. But what made you want to tackle this topic in this way?
I think it was just Scott and I started working on the show years ago, and it was just a progression. I mean, it just went from all over the place, from the lead character being a very much a traditional handsome boy next door type to now he's a tattooed, rage filled punk rocker type. So it just was a long progression. I mean, we worked on this a long, long time, and it went through various, versions, and we just kind of came to this.
And so the protagonist is Michael, who's played by transgender actor North Rory Homeward.
Correct.
And he is, it's really nice to see him singing one of Scott's signature songs, Nobody Is Gonna Ever Fall in Love with Me.
The Muffin Song, yeah. The Muffin Song,
yes. Why do you call it the Muffin Song?
Because there's a little line in there, no one ever kissed and called me Muffin.
Aww. But can we call Scott Muffin now? Muffin, Scott, Muffin. You're my muffin. We're making it happen.
Well, and Scott, it's great to see sort of all your music sort of being portrayed and voiced by other actors. And, I just realized, God, you're so fucking miserable.
But now the characters are miserable. I am no longer miserable.
He's projected it onto them. It's a transference.
The fun thing about the Muffin Song, No One's Ever Gonna Fall in Love with Me, is that it's this character who's demanding love. And finally, we start to realize that he's asking for a lot more than just a hug and a kiss.
Right.
The end of the song is no one's ever going to jump off a building.
Go on a killing spree.
Yeah.
Which is so funny that, the lyrics fit 10, 15 years later into Zombie Bathhouse so well.
Originally, what made you want to write that song in the first place?
Yeah, it was about a person who... Yeah, it's about a person who wants too much,
There's so much that they can't fall in love with anybody.
Yeah, it wasn't me, but it's a person, right? There's a reason why no one has fallen in love with this person. Expect everything.
Yeah, and I think you see that on social media a lot. People with their Facebook status updates, and they have this long list of requirements that they have for my future partner is going to be all of this kind of stuff, and I'm just kind of oh, honey, you are in for a world of hurt if you think you're getting all that.
Well, and Scott, you've always dedicated your career to embracing the LGBT underdog. I mean, for years you've sort of been ahead of the curve in terms of talking about diversity, but also gender nonconformity and sort of including that in a lot of our cultural spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of that was just that I provided a space, and I'm thinking of Homo Latte.
And you're really turned on by black men, so you're like, this is a good way to get laid.
Homo Latte?
Because I was always thinking, you're always going out of your way to include, a racially diverse group of people, and to me, I was always part of it is that you have a strong effect. Your husband now is an African-American man, but you always dated a lot of, good-looking black men throughout your life.
Oh, gosh, there hasn't been that many.
I have a couple names.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, my God, people we must go way back. Because Cheetah and I have been married 17 years
I know
now.
A lot more about your past. In fact, in one article that you were in the Windy City Times, you talked about, and see if I remember this quote, that it was very liberating for you when you started opening up yourself to sexual experiences from a wide variety of people. You remember saying
that? Yes. Well, it was talking about that one song where I wrote a song where I said, in fact, it was a bathhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I remember this.
Right. And the story is about, I'm so sick of people being rejected that I'm going to go to the bathhouse and just absolutely anybody who wants to have sex with me, just have sex with me and not make it this thing where somebody gets, judged and it being an issue of somebody being more attractive than the next person. So therefore they get rejected. And so, it has a lot to do with self-image and this, this kind of, I call it body fascism, where it's like there's this perfection that exists so much in the gay male community specifically that I was just kind of saying fuck that, you know. So that's what you put a lot of
energy into your own body. I mean, certainly as in the course of your life, you've been known as somebody who's very tall and muscular and athletic.
Yeah, but I also think it had to do with reaction to low self-esteem. Mm. And there's this one picture I remember.
But don't you just want to look good and have everybody go, hey, well, baby?
I don't know. Not really. But there is a self-image, and that I struggled with that. I mean, I remember I was 16 or something when our family had taken a trip to Biloxi. And there's this picture. It was summer, so I had very little clothes on. And I think we were doing, like, putt-putt golf or something. And I'm this just stick. I mean, as skinny as can be. Yeah. And it just horrified me. It horrified me. So, yeah, I worked for years and years in gyms and did all that stuff. But it wasn't to get laid, really. For me, it wasn't. But, you know.
I mean, you married a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Who competed in the gay games. Yeah, I have photos of him. He's fantastic physique.
Yeah. Well, you know. I met him at the gym. No, that's not true.
You did meet him at the gym?
No, I met him at Halston Street.
He meant J-I-M, not J-Y.
Oh, there you go.
And so you've put a lot of energy into thinking about sort of how we as a community sometimes put ourselves in the margins or are put in the margins.
Absolutely. And I don't remember specifically in this project where that came, but there's no doubt that part of this is the zombie is the oppressed group.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's all, it's, you know, it's a metaphor for how, and, you know, sort of like George Romero's The Living Dead, you know, the zombies are sort of a metaphor for our internalized oppression of humanity. And so I thought it was really fun that you guys actually sort of like took this in a very campy gay bathhouse direction.
Awesome.
Like, well, go ahead.
Brian.
But if you look at zombies, I mean, there's so many ways they've been expressed, and it started out voodoo with I Walk with the Zombie and White Zombie, and those are films, and there's just so many ways of looking at them and expressing them. Even Jason Voorhees in the last three or four of the original films, he's a zombie basically. They and Jason Lives.
You're talking about the Friday the 13th series.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He's a zombie for the last three, six, seven, eight. You know,
we discover that he's a zombie because originally he was kind of like a force of nature.
He's a force of nature, but he's dead in his grave at the opening of part six, and they dig up the grave to make sure he's dead, and a bolt of lightning comes and zaps him and
reanimates him.
So he's essentially a zombie. There's a thing called Pontypool, which is all about language as a virus, and it turns people into zombies. So it's amazing what you can do. I think everyone thinks The Walking Dead and
Frankenstein's a zombie technically,
yeah,
too,
yeah,
right?
There's so many things that are really zombies in the horror culture and there is so much significant meaning behind them.
Well, when you look at The Walking Dead, the zombies, it's kind of like cowboys and Indians. You know, we can't shoot Indians anymore. And so, these zombies are kind of a stand-in for humans. It's like you can kill a human, but they're not really human, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's all right. It's
cool. And I think the original term was ghoul. I think, Darren Clark told me that zombie was incorrect. It was actually ghouls.
Ghouls is, I guess, I looked up it on Wikipedia. Yeah. It actually comes from Arabic folklore, and it was ghouls, and they were demons. They're not the undead. So it would be a demon that would come back. And so people would talk about, like, an army of the undead or ghouls. And so I guess zombies kind of replaced it. Because zombies were something that was associated with, like, Haitian culture from Africa.
Mm. Yep.
And so originally, like, when you'd see, like, these zombies, they'd kind of be under, like, a voodoo priest's or priestess's control. And so it wasn't until, like, what is it, Night of the Living Dead, really, that zombies just became this horde of, like, flesh-eating monsters.
Yeah. What's up, ghoul friends?
Can I tell a quick little story about... this really, really... really nice guy who had just kind of escaped Nigeria to come here because of LGBT persecution. Mm-hmm. And he had just arrived maybe the week previous to Pride, and he marched into Pride, and it was the most incredible experience for him. It was so cool to hear him talk about it. I told him that I've got a musical coming out, and it's called Zombie Bathhouse. And he goes, "What's a bathhouse?" And so I had to explain to him what a bathhouse was, and in somewhat graphic detail.
Sure you did.
At the end of that, and then at the end of that, he goes, "What's a zombie?"
And so he's just like,
Nigeria, they're just behind the times.
So in Zombie Bathhouse, instead of shooting them in the head, they shoot out of their heads of their dicks.
From the head, there we go. Yeah, shoot from the head.
So the walk us through, for people who may not have the opportunity to see this because they live in other parts of the world, the idea of the show is that it's Michael is sort of an emo, you know, would you guys consider him kind of a trans character as well, or, no. or that's not
no.
not
no.
part of that?
It just happened that
we
a trans
cast the best actor for it, and he was trans, which I think is awesome. That we're just casting him as an actor, a performer.
Okay, but he's certainly like a misfit, an outcast, a nonconformist in many levels.
Based on a buddy of mine, like we were writing him as a traditional romantic hero when we first started, and it was frustrating me to no end because I wanted something unique and original. And a buddy of mine, Joey Kissling, who has passed away about a year and a half ago from cancer, was a wild ass, just crazy and tattooed, and had this great energy. And I hung out with him one night, and he actually was talking about, there's some lines I used that are actually right out of his mouth. He was talking about going home from his work shift and turning on porn and not even being able to masturbate because he just broken up with someone and he had no interest. And Scott and I met the next day to write on the show, and I'm like, oh man, this character's just so boring. Ah, you know, everyone writes this kind of romance. And I was like, wait a minute. We're taking place in the bathhouse, mm-hmm. and Joey was a DJ and DJed a lot at Steamworks. And I was like, wait a minute. And that's when things kind of started to change and develop. And I talked to him, I let him know. This started maybe about 6 months before he got his diagnosis, and he was cool with it. He thought it was great, and so I think that kind of...
He passed on because of cancer, HIV, or AIDS?
He had cancer. Okay. His family was had something called Lynch syndrome, which he thought was cool because David Lynch. but you're suspect or that's not the right word.
Prone to.
There we go. Mm-hmm. To just aggressive forms of cancer. And like his mother died very young. His cousins had died in their 20s and 30s. So he's kind of, you know, living on like Ash and Scrim and Quigley are living on in the show through the show. So.
And you guys kind of began the musical with sort of a song called Happy Pride. Yep. But doesn't stay too very happy or prideful very long. Can you sort of describe it for the audience?
This is Scott.
Sure.
I think what happened was, again, this was Brian saying we need a new opening.
So what was the original opening?
It was like a rap. It was a political angry rap, but it just wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't working.
It wasn't clicking.
And I think both Scott and I are, you know, are alternate gay to a certain degree. Like I'm into horror and punk and not that much in the bar scene and, you know, the traditional thing. So, and I think we love the gay community, obviously, but I think we have issues with it and certain things in it. So I think
you don't want to go shopping for rainbow merchandise made in China?
I want to go shopping for like vinyl, like old musty, like vinyl, you know, and
well, that's what's the interesting thing. The Washington Post wrote this article about how these Russian mobsters are spending millions of dollars to influence LGBT Americans by creating Facebook pages and blogs that have all this like propaganda designed to sort of lull us into this like consumer. You know, it's funny because Russians are like trying to turn us into consumer capitalists.
They're trying to make us complacent. Be like, gay is good. Isn't it great to be bisexual? Thumbs up.
And one of the major contents of these blogs is all this LGBT rainbow merchandise made in third world developing countries. You know, sort of like rainbow bands and bracelets and jewelry and all this stuff that nobody really likes or needs.
They're not the originators of this idea.
Yeah, no. So they're sort of taking our ideas and turning it back as a weapon. They're weaponizing American culture back at Americans, which is really sort of beautiful, ironic.
Yeah. But I don't get to weaponize. I mean, I know this whole Russian Facebook thing, but it's like, you know, if they had to show these ads to Congress, how influential were they? I mean, Flo at Progressive, she was influential, right? I mean, everybody knows Flo. They, you know, like even Rachel Maddow hit these Nigerian guys up there doing anti-Hillary Clinton stuff. And it's like, well, nobody saw this. I mean, how influential was it really?
So come on. You feel like we're
advertising?
You feel like it was very inconsequential, but humorous in some degree.
Well,
right?
I think it's with the Facebook stuff, though, it was like it was super targeted. And so you probably wouldn't have seen some of these things, but the people that it mattered to, they would have seen it because they were able to micro target.
But the thing is, for me, I'm sure I never saw it. Yeah. And I understand how you know, Facebook disseminates stuff. But, like, if somebody believed that Pizzagate actually existed, they were already voting for Trump and against Hillary, right? Sure. It's not like that. Oh, my God, I can't vote for somebody. I love Hillary Clinton.
I love pizza, but I hate rape. I'm so torn. But it is interesting, like, the whole idea of just creating all this kind of, you know, culture based on just, you know, it felt very Mad Libs, you know? And even if you look at the Russian anti-gay, pro-gay propaganda blogs, it's very, like, they have photos of, like, Ellen with these quotes that she may or may not have said. And it's a very interesting the way that sort of our culture has gotten to a point, LGBT culture, that it's known around the world as this entity. Mm-hmm. And people who are not necessarily experience it firsthand might have a very similar approach as us nonconformists here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we look at this rainbow merchandise and we're just kind of like, ugh.
Well, it's also too, like, those kinds of ads and that kind of propaganda is making the LGBT world, it's making it more bland. And Scott, you've been around, you've been an activist. And so, you know, like, in the 80s and 90s, being out was a very political act, you know, and now it's just like, ho hum. And so it's kind of depoliticizing who we are.
And so what's interesting, so the beginning of the song Happy Pride sort of starts exploring this whole idea. And you guys go then Happy Pride.
Happy Dread.
Happy Dread.
Happy Angst. Sorry, you take it all the way.
And to its logical conclusion.
And that's just the first song.
And that's the first song.
And will you introduce the overzealous P-Flag mom? Is she based on somebody you kind of knew in real life? The mom that's like a little just too proud of her gay
She's
son.
Obnoxious.
Not really. You know, her I think what I discovered, they always say a playwright writes a character for himself, and I don't think I've written that character for myself, but I think there's a lot of me in these characters, like, throughout the show. And my mom and I have had a difficult and strange, you know, and still, like, there's things that we just don't talk about, like, because my politics are so different from hers and her husband's, and there's things we just kind of do not. You know, we kind of shift around the room and go in a circle and keep a safe distance. So I think I always thought that the mother, even though I don't like the concept of demonizing women, because I think that's been done so often in society. But I always thought of Doris, the mother in the show, as being kind of the real monster, Michael's monster, you know, the thing that, you know, they just are at this impasse, and until he gets over that, and she's kind of the creature in the show. And it's based more on emotional and their history than, like, women being an evil force or anything like that. So I think, so she is kind of, their relationship is kind of based on my relationship with my mother.
But what's interesting here is that, you know, sort of the way the song Happy Pride looks at the mainstreaming and the commercialization of LGBT identity, Michael's mother is very much in the same scope. She is so pro-gay that she's dying to mainstream her son by pairing him up with the most, you know, innocuous blonde twink she can find.
Yeah. Brilliantly played by Michael Cadwell. Oh my gosh, she's incredible.
And Melissa Van Kersen, who plays, I hope I'm saying her last name right? Who's Doris, I adore as well. I just adore her.
You know, and so we slowly start to discover that she's doing some pretty awful things in the efforts to mainstream her alternative son. And that haunts him throughout the show.
I think it's guilt. I mean, she has done something to him, and I think everything that drives her is guilt. You know, she wants to make it perfect because she gave him such an imperfect childhood that she's trying to make this picture perfect thing that which doesn't exist. I mean, we all know our lives are perfect. You know, it's not a fairy tale. It's not like the perfect couple. It's not the perfect this. It's not the perfect
one that. Of my favorite songs in the second half, that sort of starts off the second half, is I Love My Son and I Love My Gun. She comes across as this NRA thing, you know, because you can't have a show with zombies without somebody getting shot in the head.
That's gonna happen.
And so we sort of tell us about that song or creating that moment there.
Well,
I think, and this is Brian speaking, and we originally had her. The show, as I said, has gone through so many variations and twists and turns. And we originally had her, I think, because Scott, as we've been talking about, has been very political. And I did a lot of stuff with Stop AIDS, and I have been political in my own way in my life. We had her as some kind of, like, a state rep, or she was like a political character, and so that was her platform, was something about guns, and I can't even remember it was like a campaign song originally that started out the show.
Yeah, she was going to have an organization that she was starting called Moms for Gays for Guns.
Yeah, that's what it was. That's what it was.
Why did you lose that? That's
hilarious.
I think it was we had placed the universe originally was like something where strange stuff was happening all the time. Mm. And which meant that the reveal of the zombies and the being in the bathhouse was not as big, because everyone in that world like knew strange shit was going on, basically. So I think it was confusing to people. And so that's why that got lost, because that was kind of part of that world. And I think, honestly, as a playwright, I wasn't sure exactly what is she fighting for? What is she trying to get done? You know, all that kind of stuff was a little vague. We had her as some kind of, you know.
Well, I think at the time I was thinking more John Waters, just total stupidity. And whereas I think Brian was bringing, like, again, with the character development, we didn't really have any character development yet. So with the character development, then it became more, you know, a story about the characters and less kind of, you know. Yeah,
we had crazy. Even this past winter, we did a reading at the center. And which are the person who wound up being our director, Dan Foss, who's done amazing work just looking at the script and helping us develop stuff and kind of refining things, came to see. And like Bruno was totally obnoxious. Like, he's very sweet now, and he was a totally typical obnoxious kind of bar twink character. And he and like Doris at one point were flying off the side of the bathhouse on a rainbow colored, you know, shoelace, and just stuff that obviously could never ever happen, and they were like squeezing down, you know, tight corridors, and it was totally
because your mom's in the bathhouse,
unrealistic. So I think bringing Dan on, and I think I always had this concept that, you know, there could be like a more emotional core to it, and that's kind of what has happened over the last 6 or 7 months.
Speaking of John Waters, one of the actors in the show plays one of the zombies, Seamus Jarvis. Yeah. For people who can't see him, he looks like a porn version of the Geico caveman, which, believe it or not, they actually tried to do a sitcom with those actors. It was such a popular advertising campaign that they developed a sitcom with them, and it didn't do too well because nobody wants to see a sitcom based on an ad campaign, but people love the Geico cavemans, and Seamus really is a sexy version of the Geico caveman.
That's awesome.
And I'm like,
Seamus is a total compliment, man. It's a total compliment. If you ever listen to this, it's a total compliment.
Well, he obviously is trying to play it as a sort of this wild, you know, Captain Caveman.
he's amazing. Yeah. And we have had twists and turns through this production, and lost some cast members, and it's an original work, so there's crazy stuff happening all the time, and everyone who has done anything creative knows what a nightmare and what a monstrous, to tie into the zombie theme, thing it can be to put on a show, especially when you've got a certain budget and a certain time limit and all that kind of stuff. So we lost cast members throughout the process and have built Seamus's character up because he was so amazing.
What was that audition process kind of like, as you've got a title Zombie Bathhouse and people showing up like, what the hell is this show even about?
That was kind of me, just like, you know, again, being John Waters, it's just like, well, I was really surprised. I was actually volunteering at the center doing a live music series, curating it, called Off Center. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was kind of at the center hanging out. And so I just went to, I think it was last, I don't know, January or something. And I said to Tico, the director, I said, well, what would you think about doing Zombie Bathhouse as a Halloween thing at the center? And he was like, okay. And so that's how it happened. I was kind of like, oh, there's no way.
And now you're like, oh, shit, we have to make this happen.
There's no way the center at Halstead's going to do something called Zombie Bathhouse. But he was into it.
Well, because this is a community center in Chicago where there's a lot of people who are hurting. There's therapists all over the building. There's support groups. And here you come with this really punk, radical, irreverent show. And I think sometimes the audiences are a little bit, you know, don't know what to make of it. it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's the best therapy out there, though, right?
Yeah.
Just get them out of themselves.
Yeah. Scream therapy is always good.
Yeah, yes. scream therapy. Yeah.
I think
scream
it's queen the value of Halloween is that we're pretending to be scared as opposed to actually being scared.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
It's refreshing.
It is. Right. And I think the actors, speaking of refreshing, you had asked what they... I think they came to the audition and... obviously, we worded it so we knew it was what it was going to be, and some of them were totally enthusiastic. Like the guy who wound up playing Jason, like even came to us, which I've never seen happen at an audition before, and asked specifically to read for that role because he was really interested in it. So I think the people who were there like read through the stuff and really committed. But we had a ton of straight guys come to audition for this.
Hot.
What were they?
Not I want to be in the gay show.
Was most of your cast queer?
I think it's mixed. Yeah. I think it's heavily mixed.
So actually. You mean those guys that are kissing each other, they're not really feeling it?
I don't know. We would have to bring them on to ask them.
It's called acting.
Yeah, it's called acting.
Yeah, because you have a lot, and that's really nice to see. Like, yeah. I hate it when actors are supposed to kiss each other, and they kiss each other on the cheeks, and I'm like,
no,
what?
Well, I'm sure that makes a great something on the resume, because that's going to stand out. Zombie bathhouse, what's that?
Yeah.
It's going to get people's attention for sure, you know. You had you were approaching Steamworks, which is a huge... business here in Chicago and nationwide. They're the largest chain of gay bathhouses as sponsors. And, you know, they're like, I'm sure they raised an eyebrow or two, and they're like, a horror musical about a gay bathhouse? I'm not so sure. How did that conversation go about?
Well, I can understand their concern. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of the community is just so anti-bathhouse. And like one of my slogans that I like to say is that, you know, meeting somebody at a bar and going home with them to your house or their house is unsafe sex, right?
You don't know dangerous. This person.
It's dangerous. Mm. Going to a bathhouse is safe sex. Right? Safe space.
How's that any different?
That it's somebody at their house. You go to their house and you may not come out alive.
You might walk into somebody's murder castle. Yeah. You know what I mean? The next thing you know, you're in a chamber and they're sucking out all the oxygen.
Right. Yeah. So it's unsafe sex. But if you go to a safe space... That's safe sex to me. I think bathhouses are better.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, I think a lot of people, they just kind of feel vulnerable there because they're not comfortable with public nudity or wearing a towel and those kinds of things. So for them, it's also, too, I think a lot of people, they feel as though it's like intentionally seeking sex. There's something kind of wrong with that it
absolutely.
Just has sex to happen. There has to be some kind of romance there or something.
Right. Sex shaming. Absolutely. Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, anytime we've been to a gay bathhouse of any kind, you always see like the regulars.
Oh,
and you know, in your musical, the regulars happen to be historical figures. It's not Harvey Milk, but it's Chicago's equivalent of that.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I mean, that was Brian's doing again. He wanted to bring in a song that I had done previously, but the lyrics didn't make sense for it at all. Mm. And so...
is that Mouthful of Cock? What are you saying?
No, it was...
One of our favorite songs.
You just had to mention that, didn't
That's
you?
That's one of the best
That's
songs
one of our favorite
ever.
Songs.
It's Mouthful of Cock. What are you saying? And then recite the Pledge of Allegiance with a dick in your mouth.
And the Lord's Prayer. It gets worse. Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And
any drag queens out there want to lip sync it, it's a great song to lip sync.
Yeah, go look it up. You know, it's out there.
All you need to do is shove a dildo into your mouth on stage and when he's gagging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're going to make the audience gag.
It's also a great sex technique when you're having sex with somebody and they're blowing you and you get them to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh.
Is that where that comes from? Right. I just thought it was because it was outrageous.
If you want to bring out your dom side. Talk dirty to me and they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
So was Steamworks like completely cool with it? Were they like
they asked for the script? Yeah. They asked for the script and I sent it to them. So who knows if they read it? I mean, but
I don't blame. I mean,
they did ask for the script.
And there's been some incidents of drug-related deaths there. So at bathhouses. So they're very concerned. Mm-hmm. They're very worried about.
Yeah, and people die everywhere all the time.
Yeah,
people die in planes. They die in hotel rooms. But because it happens in an environment where people have sex, then all of a sudden it's super sensationalized.
Well, also, too, as a community, we love sort of egging each other on. And people say, like... well, somebody died there, but their ghost haunts there. And the ghost might possess your body and get you to suck dicks that you don't glory want hole to. Number
five. I think you're writing the sequel right there. So you've got the sequel going on, my
don't
man.
Don't trust the ghost in room 269. We actually were, Mark and I have been writing a series of sort of inspired by 60 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, I thought that's where your inspiration was.
What was it? Yeah. It was 50 Shades of Halloween. So it was like a Twilight Zone, but sex stories.
Oh. I have a new one coming.
And and so that's
as it were.
And one of them was I wanted to have, because we have a neighbor who's like, he was obsessed with a guy at the gym who kept showing his penis to him.
He would cruise him in the locker room, and he totally wasn't into it. And the way he kind of diffused the situation is he just kind of became friends with him. And so the guy stopped. But the apartment that he lives in, before he lived there, we were friends with this guy named John. And John was a gay guy, and I used to hang out with him and talk with him. And we'd run into him in the bars, and he ended up dying.
In his apartment.
I guess he'd been there for a couple of days because he had some kind of fever and just died. And so we say that sometimes Eric's possessed by his ghost. And he's a bisexual unwillingly.
I'm hungry.
I want cock. And that's a part of the fun thing about the musicals, that you sort of have this, you know, the zombies are kind of ghost-like in that sense, that they're sort of haunting the venue, and the main characters are sort of discover that.
Yeah.
Yep.
With sexy and hilarious results.
Now, Brian, you, besides writing this, you also do, you're a writer and a podcast, and you also do videos on YouTube. Yep. Where you interview a lot of scream queens.
Yeah.
Who have you interviewed that's like, kind of stands out to you, and what were you kind of surprised to learn from them, or...
Linnea Quigley, who's the queen of the screams, is amazing.
Who is she? What has she done?
She has done, she's in, Night of the Creeps, Return of the Living Dead, Sorority Babes, and the Slime Ball Ballorama. She's like the queen of horror films, mm-hmm. to end all horror films. But I interviewed Herschel Gordon Lewis, who mm-hmm. is the godfather of gore, and mm-hmm. Mick Garris, who's done stuff with Stephen King. I mean, just amazing, amazing people. We just spent the weekend with Felissa Rose, mm-hmm. who is Angela in Sleepaway Camp. And there's
holy shit.
Sleepaway Camp's got that weird gay story, right?
Yeah, the gay storyline. And a trans angle, and yeah. You just said one of the most interesting things. She told me this weekend when we were talking on stage was, of course, these women have huge fans, and they're geeky and awkward sometimes. Mm-hmm. And
the women are, or the fans,
the fans, okay. And the women too sometimes. Like, okay. And so we were talking about fan encounters, and the guy she's married to was actually a musician. Like, he was in CKY, which was a metal band, and he was a huge fan of Sleepaway Camp, and he was on Jackass one time, and she was watching it, and he had a t-shirt with her on it. And his guitar, I guess he put her image on that as well, from Sleepaway Camp, and basically he fanboyed her, like, tracked her down, and she was freaked out at first, but he was very persistent, and they did a little-known sequel called Return to Sleepaway Camp many uh-huh. years after the original Sleepaway okay. Camp. And so she finally like, oh, fine, just come to the set. So we actually flew to the set, and within 5 minutes they were like, boom, this is it. And
wow, got she married her stalker.
Married her stalker, yes.
Just like me.
There you go. It's like
me.
I'm just kidding.
You'd love her then. You two would get along. Well, she's, you know, a doll.
When you look at Sleepaway Camp now though too, like nowadays it's kind of problematic in some senses, yeah. right? Because in the end it's revealed that the killer is
was a boy forced to pose as a girl. Mm-hmm. As Angela. And that happens a lot in those films. Okay. Terror Train. There's a whole... I've got lists.
Wait, so it's been a long time since I've seen Sleepaway Camp. Angela is the murderer?
Is the murderer.
Okay.
You find out eventually.
Played by a woman.
Spoiler alert! Played by Felissa.
Played by her.
Who was 13 at the time, a young girl.
At 13 at the time.
She was 13 at the time, yeah.
And then they had flashbacks to her being a boy.
Yes. So it's for those who have not seen it, stop listening right now. But basically, she is.
Well, the movie was made in what, 1983?
So it's been a while. But her aunt adopts her after the father is killed. And since the aunt is nutso and already has a boy, she can't have another boy. So she forces the boy to become Angela. So she's got a son and a daughter.
And what was the sequel like?
They did, you know, the sequels are, they're right and boom, boom, in quick succession. They did Sleepaway Camp 2, Sleepaway Camp 3, which were done, they based on Robert Hiltzik, the guy who wrote the original, directed the original film, his characters. But Pamela Springsteen actually takes over the role, who's Bruce's sister, who is also in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. She's now a successful, like, photographer. Really, really respected, and doesn't want to talk about the films. And those are campy and weird and over the top. And Angela has become a transsexual woman at that point in time. She's had surgery, and but she's all about everyone being good campers. You got to be a good camper. And those are crazy and wacky and wild and offensive, totally offensive. And then Return to Sleepaway Camp happened many years after those sequels. And Robert Hiltzik, who created the original, he and his wife came back and kind of revisited the world again. And I think there's always rumors of remakes and reimaginings of that series.
So Bruce Springsteen's sister was in the horror films, and now she wants to completely distance herself from it.
As far as I know, she won't talk about it because she was a transsexual, you know,
murderer
in these films. And they are. They're really kind of nasty and fun, and I can see where people would have issues with them.
Movie like when Silence of the Lambs came out, people really protested it because they're like, if you're gonna portray trans people, can we have a trans person that's not some kind of psychotic killer?
And they're still doing it. They're still doing it. Which is Insidious 2 had a huge kind of trans twist plot line. And
did you see that terrible movie with Michelle Rodriguez that came out when Sigourney Weaver? It was a forced feminization where she forces her to undergo sexual reassignment surgery, but it wasn't like
crazy
that. It was
Sigourney Weaver Michelle Rodriguez.
I'm going to punish this guy by giving him a sex change. And then he goes on a murder spree.
What's that saying? You know? That's punishment.
I just wondered to myself, like, how the hell did Sigourney Weaver even get involved in that?
Yeah, well, Jennifer Lawrence did one on her rise. I think it's called The House at the End of the Street, but it's with Elizabeth Shue, and there's another trans twist that kind of makes it look like, you know, if someone forces you to dress up in a dress, you're going to be a psycho, so this is not 30 years ago. This is contemporary. So that really does need to, you can almost maybe forgive
something from the 80s
because they're trying to be outrageous. And there's tons of films that did that twist. Terror Train was one of them. Twist of, it's a woman in a dress, so doing the killing. And so, you can almost maybe go, that was another era, but.
Fantastic. So Zombie Bathhouse, a rock musical, is right now running at the Center on Halsted. The shows are on the weekends or?
Saturday, Sundays. Saturdays at 7, Sundays at 3, and I think there's the final week, there's a Thursday at 7 as well.
And dress up as your favorite character for a discount.
That would be awesome. we would love for that to happen, to have cosplay and all that kind of stuff.
It runs till October 29th, and you guys can check out more information through, you guys have a...
There's a website.
Zombiebathhouse.net. Right now with Cooking with Drag Queens, we have two more days, just 2 days to save Cooking with Drag Queens. It's may not make it. So right now, as of taping this, we're 63% funded. $12,717 have been pledged. But as you know, with Kickstarter, if we don't reach the full amount, not a single penny goes to the project. And all those pledges go back to the people who made them.
Now, last time we did this, we had 460 backers. At this time, we have 270. So if we could just get about 190 people to step forward and say,
$3.
Hey, yeah, $3, whatever, $100, $1,000 if you can do it. Whatever you can do, if we can just step forward and make that pledge today, we'll get to our goal much sooner. And we'll actually get to our goal, because at this point in time, we're sweating here.
I can almost taste it, honey. We're so close.
We're so close. And so I'd hate to see that this end, because we do have this fantastic episode. You can check it up on YouTube right now. It's our last episode of Cooking with Drag Queens. It's a new episode, and it's with Perfidia, Queen of the Big Wig, and she is somebody you may have seen in the documentary film Wigstock. She styled the wigs for season 2 of Strangers with Candy, and also Miss Yvonne and Pee Wee's Playhouse on Broadway, which was also nominated for an Emmy.
And the musical Big Wig, and now she's touring with all the stars on Hedwig and the Angry Inch musical, as well as she's styling the wigs in Broadway.
Yeah, she
on Broadway.
She styled the wigs for Neil Patrick Harris, for who's the guy from Glee?
Oh, I'm Darren like Criss. Darren Criss. He was the hot. We saw him in person when we were filming that. He went, no cameras.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't.
He walked in the room and then she's like, move.
Move out of the way. This is about me.
Yeah.
Not about you. Mm-hmm. It was actually great to be able to bring cameras backstage. This is something that never happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, publicists and Broadway is very secretive about their process, and they don't want anybody to see what's going on. So the fact that we were able to bring cameras backstage and show you the magic as it's being made is never before seen, and probably after this never will be seen again. You know, Cooking with Drag Queens cannot continue without your support, and we know you guys believe in the series. We know you believe in the project. It's been a tremendously challenging year. We've seen devastation ecologically, politically happening all around us. And when this kind of horrific things happen, you just kind of shut down. You break down. You don't want to leave the house. You don't want to go see musicals like Zombie Bathhouse. You want to lock yourself up and make some hot tea and rock yourself to sleep as you cry in a corner. But damn it. Hell no. We're going to get out of the house. We're going to celebrate our community, and we're going to do diverse and fun things. Art matters. Mm-hmm. The Black Lives Matter movement actually may have been inspired by the Art Matters movement, which precedes it. Oh. And it was a nonprofit organization to encourage arts in schools and communities, because when we remove the arts, we remove people's quality of life and ability to have creative thinking, to solve problems in new and unprecedented ways. And certainly, honey, our plate is full here. We're back in the late 80s and at the height of the AIDS crisis once again. Mm-hmm. How do we get out of that? We made art. You made art. You were part of all this, Scott, in the late 80s and early 90s.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk about that environment and that atmosphere.
Absolutely. There was no doubt that a lot of the energy that was going on was a reaction. And in fact, that HomoCore is doing a 25th anniversary in November.
Wow. HomoCore is?
HomoCore was the queer punk live music series started by Mark Freitas and Joanna Brown. And I did a couple of their shows. I had a queer punk band, Scott Free Trio. And so that, yeah, it was a really active time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, queer punk was like a new thing. Mm-hmm. I think 1991, it may have started in like Toronto and so pretty quickly spread around the country. So HomoCore Chicago was just the,
I didn't realize Mark was the focal point for HomoCore.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And he still looks good.
He's a legend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so they're doing a 25th anniversary, November 2nd, 3rd, 4th. It's like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday at Defibrillator Gallery. And I'm performing the Friday night with Jenny Urban. And Thalia Zedek from the band Come is performing, I think, Thursday night. And
are the Rotten Fruits getting back together?
I have not heard that.
So the Rotten Fruits was Mark's group.
Right.
And the drummer is an openly gay Chicago police officer.
Germ. Who's a huge horror fan.
Huge horror fan. And one day, Mark and I were walking down Halsted Street, and a police car pulls over and rolls down its window and says, "Hey, faggots, get over here."
And did like, you?
I was more, I was like,
we're like,
oh,
what?
My God.
Because I didn't recognize him, but Fausto recognized him.
I was like,
what the hell's going on? You scared the hell out of me.
I was so fucking scared. He's a friend of ours, so.
Yeah, he DJs at Touche also. Mm.
He's an extraordinary person, you know? Yeah. And just really the people who involved in all this stuff were really sort of, you know, part of that scene. I don't, you guys are familiar with David Sedaris. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people came from that same cultural scene ecosystem that happened at the time. And there was a club, Lower Lynx. You remember that?
Right. Oh, you sure?
Yeah. And David Sedaris and Joan Jett Black and the Rotten Fruits and Feast of Fools. That what we do is came from that environment.
Absolutely.
You think we're going to come up with original ideas? We're just like, hey, this is a good idea. Let's do it ourselves. You know. And it was the idea of bringing your community together in a space. And doing a show that had, you know, musicians and drag queens and performance poets. And the idea is that you kept everybody sort of really limited in time. So it was one.
Yep, that always went over.
But everybody, fuck it. You said 10
my
minutes.
Piece is 5 minutes long and you're like 20 minutes. You're like, get the fuck off.
Get off the stage, you bitch. You're hogging the mic.
And were you guys around for Foxy's in the show Tuck?
No. Yeah, it was so Foxy was a gay bar in Chicago.
It was where Spin is.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was like
the corner Halstead and Belmont.
Right.
Where Furious Spoon is now or something.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, right. And I'm going to forget his last name, Michael, but he had a show called Tuck. And what he did was he really, he kind of went to the gay queer art community and pulled them in to do drag. So it was more performance people like
he was force feminizing artists.
Yeah, I did drag there twice, which was really difficult.
You're
for
a bigger.
Me.
How tall are you right now?
I'm 6'5".
And yeah, you are.
It's funny how when
muscular, 250 pounds.
And then when you do drag, you realize how big your nose is, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's all of a sudden, it's like, wait a second.
And unfortunately, at that time period, nobody knew about contouring except the pageant queens. Okay. And so we are, you look at even RuPaul or Lady Bunny back in the day, we're all booger queens.
Lady Bunny still doesn't contour.
She contours a little bit.
A little bit.
She's the one who actually got me putting a dark foundation underneath your chin to hide your double chin. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It's like a beard, but in reverse.
Yeah. It also makes your face smaller, because women, you know, have a little bit of smaller faces, right?
What are you talking about?
And the other thing that was weird for me was that friends that I've known for years are suddenly coming up and kissing me. I was like,
oh, and the lips.
Because you're a woman?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they feel like they're going to hug
you.
It
was just such a weird, it's like, you know.
Harvey Weinstein! But, yeah.
It was weird. I wasn't very good.
You didn't enjoy being sexually harassed and... In drag?
Well, I mean, I tried it like I made
it. It doesn't look like you did from the expression on your face right now.
You seem like I'm comfortable about it.
Yeah.
Well, I made a dress out of paper mache. And so it was really brutal and
out
awful.
Of paper mache?
Yeah, it was
crispy.
A bad idea.
It was like an eggshell.
It was a really bad idea.
So this thing didn't bend or move.
No, and it was wire. Because I just thought about when I was like a little kid and making little paper mache things. I was like, okay, that'll make a good dress. No, bad idea.
Yeah, you can't
I was a Plaster
like
of Paris was my name.
That's a brittle name.
And with for Brian, a brittle dress.
The Feast of Fools came about as a fundraiser for an art gallery with the Radical Fairies. That's here right. In Chicago.
Oh, wow.
That led to the Feast of Fun podcast. And you were Marilyn, my mother, and
it was
me.
A Greg Shapiro story that we put on stage. Yeah.
Oh, really?
I remember that. Yeah.
It was about a gay man and his obsession with Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And did you play Marilyn?
I wasn't in it.
Oh.
I just did.
He directed it.
I directed it. I just directed it.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And and part of it was like, you know, have you ever gotten dressed up in drag or anything?
I have not.
Never?
I haven't. And I had long hair down the back to the back of my butt at one point in time. And no, I don't like the makeup on my face. I don't like all that preparation stuff. My worst class when I was at the theater school DePaul was the makeup class. I just don't like all that stuff. I don't know.
You don't like it on your face.
I don't like it on my face.
But I remember the time.
That on my face.
You were sort of things on my face. You were sort of the Marilyn Munster of the Chicago Radical Fairies because you were this blonde, muscular hunk in Daisy Dukes.
I love this. That's
and
great.
You came in, and everybody's like, "Oh, he's so fucking hot."
Oh.
Do you remember those days?
I remember those days. And here's the thing, and I think that I'm tying it back into the show. We've got this hunky guy singing I Am Not My Type. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I never thought I was attractive. So I look back at those photos and go, what was I freaking worried about?
You were a sex god.
Yeah, you know, I was fine. I was attractive. But I think it just shows, once again, tying it back into the show, that we are never happy with our bodies or how we look or we all are insecure. And yeah, I remember those days very well, but I would have never described myself as a sex god. Never.
It's okay not to look like the girls in the magazines, but fortunately, I do.
I've got to put that on the t-shirt.
That was my friend Chris and I. Mm-hmm. We were thinking about, you know, the body image issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said to him, I was like, you know, Chris, it's okay not to look like the girls in the magazines. And he said, speak for yourself. I do. We thought it was hilarious for years and years. Guys, thank you so much for giving us a little walk down memory lane. And you know, you guys are a really vital part of our Chicago community. And I know you guys dedicated your lives to making, you know, Chicago's LGBT scene a better place. And, you know, if I could give you some rainbow medals the way Obama gives Ellen, I would, you know, because you guys really have been a really important part of our history and our community's history here.
Thank you. Thank you. Both of you, too.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Maybe we could go to the Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame together. You actually said at one time that you were not, like, you did not want to ever receive one because you didn't want to shake Mayor Daley's hand.
You know, was hard. Yeah. It was hard. Mm-hmm. And I did shake his hand.
You did?
And yes.
And you actually got one?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
2010. It was his last year. And, you know, I just couldn't stand him. Him ripping up the airport. And the parking and stuff. I mean, he just.
Oh, like, that last parking. Hated, you know, I'm still angry about
just
that.
Right. But I do have to give him credit. I mean, he was there the whole time. He stayed way until the end. There was a long line of photos and stuff, and he hung out. And we saw him after in his, like, little mini, like it was a...
His roped-off area?
No, in the car. It was...
He had a Pope-mobile or something, is what you're saying?
Yeah, well, but it was a little tiny thing, and he's in the back, and he's waving back to us, and I was like, wow, that was really cool and fun, and at least, you know, even though he was evil personified, he at least got the community aspect of it, because then the next year, it was Rahm Emanuel, and he, like, gave a two-minute speech and got the hell out.
They used to make a big deal about the LGBT Hall of Fame Awards here, and like you said, like, the mayor would show up, he'd spend the time, they'd have food, it was a big thing, and I think they've kind of scaled it back because the city's gone through, like, some budget crises, and like, we've got the gay vote already secured.
Yeah, right.
We don't need to kiss their ass anymore. So.
No, it was a big, it was a big deal.
It was nice to go to the, you know, Chicago the cultural center, and eat, you know, little sandwiches and drink small amounts of wine, begrudgingly given out by the catering staff. Can you make it a double? And they're like, no.
Well, you know, a lot of this for the mayor was for politics. And early next month, we're going to be talking to Timothy Stewart Winter, who has his book now is out in paperback called, you know, Political. I think it's called Gay Clout in Chicago. And it talks about the rise of LGBT politics in Chicago and how Chicago was one of the cities that got a lot of things passed that other cities didn't.
Mm. We got some amazing things here, honey. You know, the flyover city of the third coast, so to speak. And part of it is, like, you know, Chicago's a great community to explore, to develop things. We are very close to each other. And, you know, it's a community in the sense that you know people's names, you know who they are. You even know the regulars at the Gay Bathhouse.
Yes.
And they're not going to eat you.
No, absolutely. I mean, I lived in New York. I lived in New York. And, I mean, I know Chicago is by far the best city in America, maybe the world, to do queer art. They're just...
Really?
Absolutely.
Well, you're saying that because you live here.
No, absolutely. There's nothing like Homo Latte. There's nothing. I mean, there never has been around the country. And I just pick out Homo Latte as one example because it's mine.
Homo Latte is your monthly night that you do where it's queer art, or spoken word and music.
Right. And I mean, I've been doing that 17 years. And it's just the idea that.
You used to call it Grindr.
Grindr, yeah.
Before the Grindr app existed, were using Grindr as a term to refer to LGBT culture. Why the hell were you using it? Why did Grindr become the Grindr app? I'm still confused.
Well, Grindr because it was a coffee shop, right?
Right. And it was right. The point was to do my series in a coffee shop, and Homo Latte was the original name, actually created by Darren Clark, who does the illustration for Zombie Bath Out. He came up with the idea. And the gay-owned coffee house thought it was too strong a name. So we went with Grindr, which I wasn't a fan of the sex reference.
Because Grindr is like two people bumping bodies together.
Yeah, but it's a coffee reference. Yeah. So that's what we went with for a while. Then when I moved to a different space, then I changed it back to Homo Latte.
It's also the sign language for coffee. You do a little grinding symbol if you want to. I know a very little sign language, but that one I know.
Will that work at the bathhouse if you just do that with your hands?
A little grinding.
Hey.
And so Grindr became the Grindr app because we knew Joel Simkai way back.
Well, when he first launched the app, yeah.
Now he's a millionaire.
And he doesn't return our phone calls
anymore. Like, come on, Joel, give me $3 for cooking with drag queens.
Seriously, he could fund that whole thing. Come on.
He could fund it tomorrow, yeah.
What's his name?
Joel Simkai.
Joel Simkai, come on.
Come on, baby.
Be a bro. And
a different app.
That's a different app. But, but be a good guy and fun cooking for drag queens.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're listening right now.
Just go to cookingwithdragqueens.com and pledge today.
Come on, Joel. Yeah. Come on.
Jennifer Pritzker, where are you, honey?
Yeah. What's up with her?
The world's richest openly trans person.
I don't know if she is the richest because there's another trans person that's also a billionaire. I bet Jennifer's probably richer, but... Who knows?
Not
because she's got family money.
Let me put it this way: if Jennifer Pritzker woke up tomorrow with Caitlyn Jenner's money, she'd jump off a bridge. She'd be like, as Chris Rock actually made that joke about Oprah and Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. Oh, yeah.
There's rich, and then there's wealth.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if Bill Gates woke up tomorrow with Oprah's money, he'd hang himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, you know, we have an extraordinary ecosystem here in Chicago, and it's real an honor to be part of it and to be able to celebrate this really irreverent, sassy, unconformist sensibility. You know, we talk about what it is to mean LGBT is really a sexual and gender nonconformist. Mm-hmm. Nonconformist is a real key element to the rainbow flag.
Right.
And it's the idea of embracing diversity, but also about sort of breaking out of that, of those colors. Red's just a color, man. It could be crimson. It could be, you know.
Scarlet.
It can be anything.
Cerulean.
And that's what Zombie Bathhouse at its core
is.
Blue,
isn't it?
I don't know.
Oh, that's just from Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all right. All I know. Oh, yeah. It's a color? Yeah.
It's not turquoise. It's teal.
It's kind of like that color.
It's matting.
Oh, okay.
That's it's like not cerulean. Pink. It's salmon. It's not green. It's chartreuse. And so on and so forth. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Once again,
good luck with the rest of the run at the Zombie Bathhouse at the Center on Halsted.
And cookingwithdragqueens.com, folks. We need your help. Or otherwise the zombies are going to eat us. And not in a good way. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.